Welcome to Football Army, the show that takes you inside all the major storylines dominating the NFL and NCAA landscape.
And what a week it was.
Week 11 is officially in the books. And if you are looking for any kind of clarity or, you know, stability in that playoff picture.
You did not find it. Not at all.
No. This past weekend felt less like a steady football season and more like a series of, I don't know, high-stakes crises just unfolding in real time.
Across both conferences, too. And the chaos was, I mean, it was just as intense off the field as it was on it.
Oh, absolutely.
We had everything this week. We're talking major player suspensions, costing guys hundreds of thousands of dollars. We had these stunning slides from teams you expect to be contenders in the AFC.
Traditional powerhouses.
Exactly. And then you get into these deep-seated coaching controversies and some, well, some frankly shocking and pretty sobering off-field legal stuff involving a former superstar.
That's right. Our mission today is to really unpack all of this. And we have to start, I think, with the Monday Night Football drama.
You have to.
The Dallas Cowboys dominated the Las Vegas Raiders.
Yeah.
But the story was, it was less about the final score itself and more about who was allowed to score, which, you know, brought up some fascinating and a little bit uncomfortable optics around how these games end.
For sure. And then we'll get into that stunning slide of the AFC powerhouses. I mean, the Kansas City Chiefs are hitting the panic button after another loss.
And it sparked a genuine, I think, rift between Patrick Mahomes and Andy Reid, at least in the court of public opinion.
It has. At the same time, you have the Cincinnati Bengals wrestling with a question that honestly no franchise ever wants to face.
Right. Do you bench your superstar quarterback for the long-term good when your season is, for all intents and purposes, already lost?
It's a brutal question.
And we can't ignore the discipline issue that cost Jamar Chase over $500,000 for what was described as a pretty disgusting act against the Steelers.
Yeah, that was ugly.
Plus, we'll get into that chaotic quarterback situation in Cleveland after Shedeur Sanders' brutal debut, a debut that prompted some really serious questions about how the Browns are developing their young talent.
So much to get to.
Let's start with Monday night.
Let's do it.
So the Dallas Cowboys, they put on a really spirited and dominant performance, beating the Raiders 33-16.
It was a decisive win, yeah. But it was completely defined by the emotional context around it.
Right. This was the first game Dallas played since the tragic death of their defensive end, Marshawn Nealand, who passed away on November 6th.
And you could feel it. The emotional weight in that stadium was, I mean, it was palpable even before kickoff.
You saw the team gather. They had the moment of silence for Nealand.
And the players, the coaches, everyone was wearing those tribute shirts all night. It really felt like the team rallied around a purpose that was, you know, bigger than football.
And that was exactly the theme that Dak Prescott hammered home after the game. His post-game message was, It was really powerful. He was focusing on unity and the importance of emotional vulnerability.
Which is a conversation you don't always hear from a franchise quarterback, you know?
Not at all.
He spoke directly about brotherhood. He said, and I'm paraphrasing here, it's about being vulnerable. To show courage, you have to show some kind of weakness.
Wow.
He went on, this game, it's bigger. It's about life and these connections that we're making. We have to be there for each other. And that kind of message, that can really define a team's resolve for the rest of the season.
And on the field, he backed up that whole emotional drive with, I mean, just hyper-efficient play.
Oh, absolutely. He threw 4 touchdown passes.
And they were spread out, right? It was 4 different players.
4 different players. CeeDee Lamb, Jake Ferguson, George Pickens, and Ryan Flournoy. And that secures his 8th season with at least 20 passing touchdowns.
Which is just a remarkable indicator of his sustained high level of production. It's not a flash in the pan.
Not at all. But, you know, while the scoring was spread around, the first few minutes of that game were defined by a really bizarre coaching decision. A decision that seemed to inject, like, a jolt of urgency into his top playmakers.
Okay, I know what you're talking about. The benching incident.
Exactly.
Wide receivers CeeDee Lamb and George Pickens, your 2 starting playmakers, were benched by Coach Brian Schottenheimer for the opening offensive drive.
The very first drive. And what happened?
Predictably, it resulted in a 3-and-out. A complete waste of a possession.
It was pure in-game discipline. And Schottenheimer, the players, they all declined to elaborate on the exact reason afterwards.
Just the classic coach's decision.
Right. They just said it was related to something that was missed. So, you know, you can speculate it was meeting prep or some small disciplinary infraction. But the message was crystal clear. Nobody is above the team standard.
And whatever that message was, George Pickens, He received it loud and clear and responded with, I mean, immediate electric play.
When he was allowed back on that field, he absolutely exploded.
What were his final numbers?
His final stat line was 9 receptions for 144 yards and a touchdown.
That is a monster game.
And get this, 101 of those yards were accumulated just in the first half alone.
Wow.
Lamb, too, he produced big numbers. 5 receptions, 66 yards, and a touchdown. It's a really unusual strategy, right?
It is. You bench your stars for a statement.
And then you watch them deliver massive production anyway. I guess it proved that the Cowboys could take a short-term hit for a long-term disciplinary game.
The victory was comprehensive, but this is where the conversation gets, I think, extremely interesting. It shifts from the on-field play to, like, game optics and the world outside the lines.
Mm-hmm.
With the game decided, Dallas has a commanding lead, and coach Brian Schottenheimer makes the decision to kneel the ball rather than run up the score or kick a field goal late in the game.
And Schottenheimer gave what many people saw as the classy, you know, the high road explanation. He cited deep respect for the Raiders coach, Pete Carroll.
Right. He said he had too much respect for the game and for Pete, who has been so good to me throughout his career.
So it was framed as this moment of professional courtesy between two established coaches.
That is the official narrative.
Yeah.
But you know the internet.
Oh, I do.
It immediately exploded with a wildly different theory, a theory related to prediction metrics and the final score total.
Here we go.
The final score was 33-16. If you do the math, that sums up to exactly 49 points.
Exactly 49. And this is where the fan speculation just runs wild. They weren't suggesting the Cowboys were, you know, throwing the game or anything.
Oh, of course not.
But that kneeling the ball with over 2 minutes left, deep in Raiders territory and well within field goal range, that it was a deliberate decision.
It's designed to keep the final total score at 49.
And why 49? Because so many of those prediction outcomes rely on a razor-thin line, often set at 49.5 points.
So the suggestion from the fans is that the kneel-down, which was framed as this classy moment of respect for a peer, was potentially influenced by or at the very least benefited those interested in keeping that final total under the critical 49.5 number.
Look, it's purely speculative, of course, and Schottenheimer's explanation seems genuine. But the coincidence of the score hitting exactly 49 points right at that critical moment of decision making, it certainly fueled the fire.
For a lot of people watching, it instantly became the biggest post-game talking point, even overshadowing the emotional tribute to Neiland or Dak's incredible performance.
It just illustrates how every single decision in the modern NFL is scrutinized through multiple lenses, you know, and often that lens is focused on the numbers.
So let's transition from the winning team to the losing team, because the narrative around the Las Vegas Raiders is increasingly dire.
Dire is the right word. They are a franchise in freefall. They dropped to 2-8. And that marks their 8th loss in the last 9 games.
It's just a complete collapse.
And the problem, it starts, and honestly, it ends up front. The offensive line was an absolute catastrophe on Monday night.
They were already banged up coming into the game.
Exactly. They were already down 2 starters due to ankle injuries. Colton Miller at left tackle and Jackson Powers Johnson at right guard. This required a massive forced shuffle of the line.
Can you just walk us through those specific position shifts? Because playing guys out of position, that's often a death sentence against a dominant pass rush like the Cowboys have.
It is. They were forced to move their center, Jordan Meredith, over to right guard, and then they had to insert Will Putnam at center.
Not ideal.
Not even close. The result was just chaos. Geno Smith was under constant immediate siege. He was sacked 4 times by that dominant Cowboys front.
And the pressure stats must have been through the roof.
They were. He was pressured on a staggering 41% of his dropbacks in the first half alone.
41%.
That level of pressure makes any kind of sustained offense completely impossible.
And the consequence of that O-line disaster was the complete abandonment of the run game.
Complete abandonment. The Raiders finished the night with just 12 total rushing attempts.
For how many yards?
A pathetic 27 yards. And it's just inexcusable, especially when you consider they invested heavily in the run game by drafting the rookie running back, Ashton Jeanty.
Right. He was supposed to be the guy to fix what was already the league's worst rushing attack. And on Monday, he got, what, 6 carries?
6 carries for 7 yards.
And Jeanty, he did not mince words after the loss, which to me indicates some deep-seated frustration in that locker room.
No, he didn't. When he was asked about his lack of touches and not being able to establish a rhythm, Jeanty just said his workload is up to the guys upstairs.
Oof, that's a passive-aggressive swipe if I've ever heard one.
For sure. It clearly signals his disappointment that the team isn't winning and isn't developing its highly drafted rookies. Instead, they're resorting to this predictable, pressure-prone passing attack.
The team's lack of confidence in their own reshuffled offensive line is now dictating and defining their entire offensive philosophy. It's a mess.
And beyond the offensive struggles, the Raiders' defense also showed some really serious weakness in the secondary.
Yeah, Q-Blue Kelly, who was starting at cornerback after having that fantastic two-interception game last week against Denver.
He had a terrible night against the Cowboys' receivers.
Are his numbers?
Kelly gave up 6 catches for 87 yards and a touchdown on just 6 targets.
So a perfect passer rating when they threw his way.
Yeah, perfect passer rating. And it led to immense fan frustration, especially since a lot of people are questioning why the rookie third-rounder Darian Porter is still just sitting on the bench.
They're sacrificing development for immediate results that they aren't even getting.
That's it, exactly.
But amidst all this doom and gloom for the Raiders, there was one major individual bright spot. An NFL record was actually broken.
That goes to their tight end, Brock Bowers.
An absolute stud.
He finished the night with 7 receptions for 72 yards, and that pushed his career total to 151 catches.
And that broke the record, right?
It broke Sam Laporta's NFL record for most receptions by a tight end in their first 2 seasons, and Bowers did it in only his 26th career game.
That is phenomenal production in such a short amount of time, especially when you think about the instability and, frankly, the poor quarterback play he's had to deal with.
He is, without a doubt, a cornerstone for that franchise's future. But the overall narrative around the Raiders organization is just dire.
Owner Mark Davis is under heavy scrutiny for just cycling through coaches and failing to win a single playoff game since he took over the team.
Even after hiring established names like Pete Carroll, the organization is facing major criticism for spending money on veteran players who are past their prime.
And a systemic failure to develop their draft picks outside of Bowers.
And Pete Carroll, at 74, he's the oldest coach in the league, and now he's tasked with turning around a franchise that hasn't found any stability in years.
It feels like they're just stuck in this cycle of hiring big names and then struggling to build a solid, cohesive core around them.
That's the challenge. The instability at the coaching level and the failure in drafting and developing key positions. I mean, it means this run of losing seasons is probably going to continue unless there's a massive cultural and philosophical shift in Las Vegas.
Okay, switching gears one last time on Monday Night Football, let's talk about the spectacle. Because the Manning cast, it always delivers entertainment beyond the score.
The guest list was truly stellar this week. They had former President George W. Bush on.
Who was naturally charming and funny.
He was. When Peyton Manning asked him if he always thought he'd go into public service, Bush had this classic line. He said, "No, I would have behaved a hell of a lot better in college."
That's a great self-deprecating moment.
It really was. And then you had the culinary angle. Guy Fieri, the mayor of Flavortown, came on.
To address a very important football question.
An extremely important question posed by the injured Giants running back Cam Skidobo regarding taco etiquette.
And Fieri actually demonstrated. He picked up a taco and showed the precise, correct way to eat it without losing half the fillings.
Bringing some classic culinary chaos and levity to the telecast. I mean, those are the moments that just make the Manning cast mandatory viewing.
We also have to mention the national anthem performance. It was universally praised.
For the War and Treaty, the husband and wife duo, they delivered this soaring, soulful rendition that just got overwhelming positive reaction all over social media.
People were calling it an all-time or chills-inducing performance.
Well, yeah. Some were even suggesting they should be next in line for a future Super Bowl anthem slot. It was a definite win before the game even started.
Finally, the most purely theatrical moment of the night was the Oscar-worthy flop.
Oh, this was great. Cowboys tackle Tyler Guyton took a spectacularly exaggerated fall after being, you know, lightly struck by the Raiders player Kuntz.
He sold the contact perfectly, drew an unnecessary roughness flag.
And while Dallas ultimately declined the penalty, they opted for a defensive pass interference flag on the same play. The video of Guyton's pure theatrical gold went instantly viral.
A bizarre and hilarious footnote to a dominant performance. All right, let's pivot now to the AFC, which is currently undergoing a massive and I think really unexpected power shift. We have to start with the Kansas City Chiefs.
You have to.
They suddenly look less like a dynasty and more like a playoff long shot.
The slide is just stunning. The Chiefs are now 5-5 after losing to the 9-2 Denver Broncos.
Who are red hot.
Red hot. And now they hold a 3.5 win buffer in the AFC West, For a team that has won that division every single season since 2015, this is completely unprecedented territory.
And the wider playoff picture is genuinely alarming for them. If the season ended right now, based on projections, the Chiefs would miss the playoffs entirely.
Yeah, NFL.com's projection currently gives them only a 52% chance to progress.
52%. That is frighteningly close to a coin flip for the Kansas City Chiefs.
It is, and their struggles are compounded by losses against other current wild card contenders like the Bills, the Chargers, the Jaguars.
Which complicates all a tiebreaker scenario.
It severely complicates them. They are losing the head-to-head battles that matter most in a crowded conference.
The frustration is clearly high, and we're seeing this growing rift in the public discussion around the offense's inconsistencies. Patrick Mahomes, he tried to be the calm voice of reason after the loss, you know, publicly taking the blame.
He delivered the textbook leadership response. He said the team is talented, but consistency is the issue, and that it starts with me. He admitted there are times he misses a throw or misses a protection call, and it causes drives to stall out.
Which seemed like the right move, but in a surprising twist, it led to a backlash against Coach Andy Reid.
It did. Fans are now accusing Reid of essentially throwing Mahomes under the bus with a statement that was widely perceived as weirdly deflective of his own coaching responsibilities.
And if you look deeper into the criticism, I mean, it has some merit. The frustration among analysts is that Reid is just being too stubborn right now.
His offensive scheme is failing to build in what they call easy buttons for Mahomes, you know, quick, reliable throws in the passing game.
And it's neglecting foundational principles, like a power running game married to play action passes from under center.
Exactly. Essentially, the argument is that the offense is too reliant on Mahomes being perfect on every single down, particularly when the surrounding talent at wide receiver is arguably weaker than it has been in past seasons.
When the talent pool dips, the coaching scheme has to compensate by making things simpler and more diverse.
Precisely. Reid has historically been lauded as an offensive genius, but the feeling now is that he's refusing to adapt or diversify the scheme. And that's why fans are shifting their loyalty entirely onto the quarterback who is already trying to shoulder the blame.
This conflict is the biggest narrative hanging over Kansas City, especially as they face the tough 9-2 Indianapolis Colts next week.
That's a huge game for them.
Meanwhile, down in Cincinnati, the Bengals have their own set of profound crises, starting with the health of their franchise cornerstone, Joe Burrow.
The national analysts, you know, guys like Adam Schefter, they're posing a brutally blunt question. If the Bengals keep falling, they're 3-7, they've dropped three straight, should they just bench Burrow for the rest of the season to protect his long-term health?
This is a classic agonizing debate of caution versus competitiveness. We know Burrow is fiercely competitive. He wants to play the second he's medically cleared from this turf toe injury.
But the long-term health of your franchise cornerstone is paramount, especially because this is now his third season in 6 years where availability has been a major issue.
And maybe we should pause here to explain why turf toe isn't some minor injury for a quarterback. It sounds innocuous.
It sounds like nothing, but it can be debilitating. Turf toe is a sprain of the ligaments around the big toe joint. For a quarterback, it is devastating because it's the big toe on the plant foot.
The one that anchors you.
Exactly. It's responsible for anchoring you into the ground, transferring all your weight, and allowing you to generate that push-off power. Without that anchor, you lose velocity on your throws, you lose accuracy, and most critically, you lose mobility in the pocket to escape pressure.
And playing on it just severely increases the risk of re-injury.
Or converting that sprain into a much worse tear, which requires surgery and months of recovery.
So the internal debate in Cincinnati must be fierce. A lost season does nothing for Burrow's immediate health, and risking further injury to play meaningless late-season games seems, strategically foolish for the organization.
Coach Zach Taylor has been very cautious. He confirmed Burrow is doing 7-on-7 work, could move to 11-on-11 soon, but he has specifically avoided committing to a week 12 or 13 return.
That decision has to be weighing heavily on ownership, especially since the defense just allowed the Steelers to rush for over 300 yards.
And convert more than half of their third downs in that brutal 34-12 loss. The team is just not competitive, even with Burrow's potential return looming.
And then adding fuel to this whole fire of discipline and competence issues is the suspension of their star wide receiver, Ja'Marr Chase.
This was a severe incident. It resulted in a one-game suspension because Chase was disciplined for spitting on Steelers cornerback Jalen Ramsey.
Right, during their recent loss. Chase initially denied it post-game.
But the field-level video evidence clearly supported Ramsey's claim that he was spit on, even though Ramsey was the player who got ejected for punching Chase in reaction to it.
And that one-game suspension carries a heavy, heavy financial penalty. The numbers here are just staggering.
Chase forfeited his weekly paycheck of $448,333.
$448,000.
Plus an additional $58,823 per game active bonus. That totals over $500,000.
For one game.
An immense price to pay for what is essentially an act of unsportsmanlike conduct. It speaks volumes about the lack of discipline currently plaguing a team that was built for Super Bowl contention, but is now just spiraling into chaos.
Jordy Nelson is going to hear Chase's appeal, but that video evidence is compelling. It seems likely the punishment stands.
I would think so.
All right, moving to Cleveland. The Browns are dealing with quarterback chaos on a different scale after Dylan Gabriel entered concussion protocol.
Yeah, he showed symptoms at halftime of the Ravens game, and this forced the highly anticipated debut of the rookie Shedeur Sanders, and it was, well, by all accounts, a disaster.
It was historically bad, unfortunately. Sanders finished the second half of that 23-16 loss to Baltimore, completing just 4 of 16 passes for 47 yards.
Threw one interception and registered a dismal passer rating of 13.5.
And the Browns were shut out, 13-0 in that second half.
It just demonstrates how completely ineffective the offense was under the rookie.
And the controversy here stems from coach Kevin Stefanski's admission after the game that Sanders' emergency relief snaps were his first with the starting offense since he was drafted.
Not one single first-team rep in practice.
Which prompted some really pointed criticism from former MVP Cam Newton. He suggested that Stefanski set up Sanders to fail.
By throwing him into live action with zero first-team reps. A claim that Sanders himself implicitly supported by just calling his debut rough.
When you look at quarterback development, especially in the NFL, why is zero first-team exposure considered, you know, malpractice?
Because the speed of the NFL is immense. A rookie has to build chemistry and timing with the starting offensive line, the starting receivers, particularly in a complex scheme like Stefanski's.
You can't just throw them in there cold.
No. When a backup takes the field, they should have rehearsed the core game plan with the starting unit. By denying Sanders any first-team snaps, even during walkthroughs or rotational drills, Stefanski was throwing a completely unprepared player into a live situation against one of the league's best defenses.
It raises serious questions about the development process in Cleveland, especially since they only have 2 quarterbacks on the active roster. That's dangerously thin depth.
It really is.
And this entire quarterback disaster completely overshadowed one of the most dominant defensive performances of the week, maybe even the season. Myles Garrett was an absolute wrecking ball.
Garrett's performance was just elite. He racked up 4 sacks against the Ravens, which gives him a league-leading 15 on the season.
And he tied a record, right?
He tied a record set by Richard Dent back in 1984 for 10 sacks in a 3-game span. That kind of dominance just puts him in rarefied air.
Garrett has a legitimate chance to challenge the NFL's all-time single-season sack record if he maintains this pace.
He does, and it's truly a shame that such an elite defensive performance is being wasted by the offensive struggles and volatile quarterback drama in Cleveland. You have a defense playing at a championship level and an offense operating at a developmental league level.
It's a tale of 2 teams in 1 locker room.
Absolutely.
All right, let's pivot to the NFC, where things are also getting extremely strange. We have some surprise contenders emerging and coaches doubling down on philosophies that may be winning games, but are certainly controversial.
Let's start in Chicago.
The Bears are quietly 7-3 and are currently sitting as the number one team in the NFC North after beating the Vikings 19-17 with a late field goal.
They are winning, but the victory feels distinctly uncomfortable, almost accidental at times.
Statistically, though, they're performing well above expectations. They're the 8th best scoring team, 4th in yards per game, trailing only Dallas, Buffalo, and Indianapolis.
Which is shocking. But the most interesting development is the reported tension that's brewing between Coach Ben Johnson and quarterback Caleb Williams. This is the classic battle between structure and talent.
Right. An opposing defensive coach suggested that Johnson is frustrated because Williams' improvisational off-script style, the very thing that makes him special, is deemed uncontrollable, and it just doesn't mesh with Johnson's structured coaching style.
So on one side, you have a coach who's prioritizing precise execution and structure. And on the other, you have a quarterback whose genius often emerges when the play breaks down and he has to rely on his natural athleticism.
Precisely. If you look at historical parallels, Coaches often want quarterbacks to follow the script until the fifth read, but players like Williams or even a young Mahomes, they operate on instinct.
A former head coach who weighed in on this suggested that Williams has the potential to be a top 10, even a special quarterback, if he learns when to follow the script and when to improvise.
It's the ultimate coaching dilemma. Do you curb the spectacular to ensure reliability, or do you allow the raw talent to flourish, even if it costs you some occasional breakdowns?
For now, Johnson is winning, but the tension suggests that the philosophical compromise hasn't been reached yet.
On a positive note for Chicago's offensive future, the team is committed to expanding the role of rookie wide receiver Luther Burden,
who is now playing 100% of the snaps in three receiver sets. Johnson noted that Burden has been really productive and that there's a strong argument they should get him the ball more often.
Which is a sign Johnson is willing to adjust personnel usage, even if not his core philosophy.
Right.
Okay, moving on to Detroit. The Lions lost 16-9 to the Philadelphia Eagles, who are now tied for the best record in the NFC at 8-2.
This game was a showcase for the aggressive Dan Campbell philosophy and how it can spectacularly fail.
Campbell, who has permanently taken over play calling duties for the rest of the season, went for it on fourth down an astonishing 5 times against the Eagles.
And he failed every single time, 0 for 5.
5 failures is just brutal. And critically, 2 of those attempts came squarely within field goal range. That's a minimum of 6 points potentially left off the board in a low-scoring 7-point loss.
And that's where the advanced analytics just kill you. While Campbell's identity is built on this aggression, statistically, choosing to pass on 3 certain points in field goal range for a low-percentage fourth-down conversion, it often translates directly to lost expected points added, or EPA.
So in short, his high-risk strategy statistically reduced their chances of winning that game significantly.
It did. Yet, Campbell stood before the media and absolutely doubled down on his identity. He refused to apologize or change his approach.
What was the quote?
He said, "That's who we are, that's who I am, and it bit us today."
That is quintessential Dan Campbell. He is prioritizing his brand and his locker room identity over what may be analytically optimal.
But that aggression requires precise execution, which was completely lacking, largely because quarterback Jared Goff struggled immensely.
Goff had arguably the worst game of his career. He posted his lowest completion percentage at 38% and a dismal 60.1 passer rating.
And they struggled on third down, going only 3 of 13. It was a collective failure. They had a chance late in the third quarter after a 42-yard gain put them at the Eagles 22.
And they stalled out and failed on a 4th and goal from the 3-yard line.
When your coach is willing to forego 3 points to back his aggressive identity, the players have to execute. And they simply didn't against that stout Eagles defense.
Okay, let's discuss some quarterback bounce backs in the NFC, starting with Bryce Young in Carolina. The Panthers are now surprisingly knocking on the door of a playoff spot, sitting at 6-5.
Young is demonstrating significant growth compared to his rough first 2 years. Against the Falcons this past weekend, he set a new franchise record for passing yards in a single game with 448.
Breaking the old record held by Cam Newton.
Exactly. And that record is significant, especially considering the Panthers are 6-5 this season, which matches their total win count from the previous 2 seasons combined.
And Young himself is 6-4 in the games he's played.
Part of that improvement is definitely credited to the addition of rookie wide receiver Tetero McMillan, the 8th overall pick this year. He seems to be providing Young with that reliable, dominant target they desperately needed to anchor the passing attack.
Young's performance, particularly his vertical passing game, is showing signs that he is rapidly maturing into the franchise quarterback they drafted him to be.
And down in Tampa Bay, Baker Mayfield is also resurrecting his career and becoming a fixture in the NFC playoff picture.
Despite all the injuries that have been plaguing the Buccaneers' offense, the fans are now increasingly regarding Mayfield as their franchise quarterback.
He's been efficient, he's been resilient, and most importantly, he's been consistent.
And Mayfield's improved play, coupled with a surging running game, is definitely helping. Running back Sean Tucker is heating up.
He is. He became the first running back this season to run for over 50 yards against the Patriots last week, and then followed that up by rushing for over 100 yards and scoring 3 total touchdowns this week. Coach Todd Bowles confirmed they're sticking with the hot hand.
Tucker's resurgence gives them that offensive balance they desperately needed to take the pressure off Mayfield.
And while the supporting cast is stepping up, The consensus remains that the team is succeeding because Baker Mayfield is playing right, which is a crucial factor in their playoff push in a wide-open NFC South.
Finally, we need to touch on the NFC West battle, where the Los Angeles Rams won a tight one against the Seattle Seahawks, 21-19.
Which allows the Rams to remain atop the division at 7-4.
This game was decided almost entirely by one factor.
Turnovers. Seahawks coach Mike McDonald gave a very honest assessment of quarterback Sam Darnold's performance, whose four interceptions were officially called the deciding factor in the loss.
Four interceptions. Despite the Rams' defense delivering a dominant effort for much of the day and shutting down Matthew Stafford, those four turnovers were just too massive to overcome.
Darnold did manage to lead a late touchdown drive and move the team into fringe field goal range for a potential win, but the mistakes defined the narrative and cost them a critical divisional victory.
On the Rams' side, wide receiver Davante Adams was encouraged by the win, despite saying the offense played like crap.
Adams himself had a low-volume day with just one catch, but he extended his touchdown streak to 7 TDs over 4 games, giving him a league-leading 10 scoring grabs on the season. The Rams are learning how to win ugly.
And what about injuries in Seattle? There was some good news on guard Gray Zabel's knee injury, right?
Yes. Coach McDonald said the initial testing showed nothing significant, calling him day-to-day. That's a huge positive for their offensive line stability moving forward, which they desperately need.
All right, we've hit that point of the season where injuries are just piling up and forcing major changes on rosters and depth charts all over the league.
It's attrition season.
Let's run through the most important health concerns and personnel moves, starting with quarterbacks. The biggest story here involves Aaron Rodgers.
The Steelers quarterback. He suffered what is reported to be a slight break in his non-throwing wrist during the win over the Bengals. His status for Week 12 against the Bears is currently uncertain.
So if Rodgers can't go, the focus immediately shifts to Mason Rudolph.
Right, and Coach Mike Tomlin has publicly valued Rudolph's consistency as a backup, noting that he always delivers when called upon.
And Rudolph actually played surprisingly well in relief against the Bengals. He completed 12 of 16 passes for 127 yards and a touchdown.
And that consistency is key. While the Steelers are highly unlikely to stick with Rudolph once Rodgers is fully healthy, Rudolph has carved out a niche as a reliable short-term solution. He seems comfortable stepping back into that role.
Okay, in Houston, Texans star quarterback C.J. Stroud remains deep in concussion protocol.
Yeah.
And he's considered unlikely to play in Thursday night's game against the Bills. For him to be cleared, he needs to clear 2 full practices by Tuesday, which is a very long shot given the short week.
Davis Mills, however, has stepped up pretty well in Stroud's relief. He's led the Texans to 2 straight wins and brought their record to a respectable 5-5.
The Texans are going to need a big performance from Mills against the Bills, especially given how effective Josh Allen is for Buffalo. The game instantly changes from a young gunslinger duel to a battle of attrition led by Mills.
And back in Cleveland, Dylan Gabriel is also officially in concussion protocol after showing those symptoms at halftime of the Ravens' loss.
Which, as we discussed, led to the disastrous Shedeur Sanders debut. The Browns' QB depth chart is certainly volatile right now.
Moving to the Jets, we have a major quarterback decision that affects the entire outlook of the franchise. Justin Fields has been officially benched.
Benched due to poor performance, and Tyrod Taylor has been named the new starter.
This benching is incredibly significant because it makes the future of Fields in New York beyond the 2025 season extremely murky.
This is the second time this year he's been benched. A team that was hoping he could be the long-term solution now has some really tough decisions to make about potentially moving on from him next year.
It signals a possible return to the draft market for a franchise quarterback.
It does.
On a more serious and deeply concerning note regarding the Jets, New York police are currently seeking a suspect in the shooting of cornerback Chris Boyd, which took place outside a restaurant in NYC.
That's a deeply worrying off-field headline for the organization and a serious safety concern for the player.
Absolutely.
Okay, moving on to skill position injuries. The Green Bay Packers received some relatively good news on running back Josh Jacobs.
Yes, he avoided a significant knee injury in their win over the Giants, which is a huge relief, though his status for Week 12 is still up in the air.
So if Jacobs misses time, this means we'll likely see an uptick in snaps for Emmanuel Wilson and Chris Brooks. And Brooks, in particular, only had 5 snaps against the Giants but made a crucial play. He picked up a blitz that allowed Jordan Love to complete a 33-yard gain. That specific play just highlights the importance of backup depth in pass protection.
The Buffalo Bills' offense may have to adjust significantly on a short week before that Texans game, as wide receivers Curtis Samuel and Mecole Hardman both sustained injuries.
Yeah, Samuel has an elbow and neck issue. Hardman has a calf injury. Both did not practice Monday. Losing two key receivers on a short turnaround puts immense pressure on Josh Allen to perform with fewer weapons.
And finally, the San Francisco 49ers are dealing with a kicker issue of their own. Eddie Pinheiro is week to week with a grade one hamstring injury.
That injury has forced the 49ers to look at a group of kickers for a workout this week, which is never a good sign late in the season. Plus, wide receivers Brandon Ayuk and Jacob Cowing are also week to week. The receiving core is going to be tested.
Now we come to the off-field news, and we have to address the profoundly serious legal situation surrounding former All-Pro receiver Antonio Brown.
This isn't a quick update. This requires a serious and careful exploration of the legal mechanisms at play here. This is an incredibly severe situation.
Antonio Brown is facing an attempted murder charge that carries a mandatory minimum sentence of 20 years and a maximum sentence of 30 years.
And this complexity is rooted in the firearm enhancement that's attached to the charge stemming from a May 16th incident.
Let's break down that legal mechanism for the listener, because the difference between 20 and 30 years is, I mean, it's crucial.
The underlying charge is second-degree attempted murder. In the state where this happened, that typically carries a maximum sentence of 15 years. However, a prosecutor confirmed this week that because a firearm was allegedly used in the commission of the crime, that immediately triggers a sentencing enhancement.
Which essentially doubles the maximum possible sentence to 30 years and creates that mandatory minimum of 20.
So the severity isn't just the charge itself, but the use of the weapon is what forces that elevated sentencing range. Brown is currently out on a $25,000 bond and has to wear a GPS ankle monitor.
And regarding the details of the incident, the accusation is that Brown grabbed a handgun from a security guard after a celebrity boxing match in Miami and fired two shots at a man who had been in a fistfight with him earlier.
The alleged victim told investigators that one of the bullets grazed his neck.
Brown has publicly maintained that he was defending himself, claiming he was jumped by multiple individuals who were trying to steal his jewelry.
His lawyer also stated in a previous hearing that Brown used his personal firearm and that the shots were not aimed at anyone specifically.
Regardless of the final legal outcome, the news of Brown potentially facing decades in prison has ignited a highly polarized reaction from fans online. The response runs the emotional spectrum from shock and frustration over his Hall of Fame path being derailed to profound sympathy.
And the sympathy element often points back to the high-profile hits he took during his career, particularly the Vontaze Burfict hit.
For those unfamiliar, that was a brutal helmet-to-helmet hit delivered by Burfict in 2016 during a playoff game, which many people, including medical professionals, believe was the inflection point for Brown's behavior becoming erratic and unpredictable.
That specific hit became the center of a national conversation about player safety and CTE. And while we can't diagnose anything, the correlation between that hit and Brown's subsequent high-profile incidents fueled the speculation that maybe there's something bigger going on mentally that the league failed to address.
And that leads to the systemic criticism directed at the NFL itself. Fans are questioning the league's long-term care and support systems for former players, asking, "The NFL loves you until they don't. Where are the support systems?"
Brown's legal issues continue to define his polarizing legacy: a legendary talent, a cautionary tale, and a symbol of the NFL's complicated and often criticized relationship with player wellness and mental health.
Moving to another high-profile legal headline involving an NFL star, Stephon Diggs filed a serious lawsuit against a social media influencer this week.
Yes. Diggs, who is dating Cardi B, filed the lawsuit against Christopher Blake Griffith for allegedly falsifying a story.
And the claims in the falsified story were incredibly heavy and serious.
Including allegations that Diggs drugged and sexually assaulted Griffith and conspired to have him killed to suppress his gay bisexual secrets from becoming exposed.
That is extremely serious libel and defamation. And Cardi B herself, who recently welcomed her first child with Diggs, has publicly shared screenshots and chat logs asserting she has concrete evidence or receipts to discredit these accusations and support Diggs' claims.
It's a messy, high-profile legal fight that has spilled over into the celebrity and music world, adding yet another layer of drama to the off-field news this week.
Let's end the news bliss with a couple of fun pop culture crossover notes, starting with the Thanksgiving halftime show lineup.
Always a highlight of the holiday football slate. We have some blockbuster musical acts lined up for the triple header.
For the Packers at Lions game.
Detroit native Jack White will perform at halftime, with CeCe Winans performing the national anthem.
And the Chiefs at Cowboys game will feature the always entertaining Post Malone headlining the halftime show.
Which is a great cultural fit for the Dallas crowd. And finally, Lil Jon will be performing at the Bengals at Ravens game, bringing his legendary hype energy. A truly stellar and diverse lineup.
And finally, let's talk about injured Giants running back Cam Scott-Dabo, who made a surprise appearance outside the facility. Specifically, he was on Monday Night Raw.
Yes, Scott-Bo, who is out for the season with a season-ending ankle injury, got into a shoving match with the WWE stars, specifically the Judgment Day, alongside comedian Andrew Schultz at Madison Square Garden.
I have to say, for a player recovering from an ankle injury that ended his season, watching him get physical on television raises a few eyebrows among fans.
Oh yeah, people were online saying things like, tell Cam to stay at home, we need him 100% next year, and just expressing frustration about an injured player getting into any kind of physical altercation, staged or not.
It definitely captured attention. Despite the staged nature of pro wrestling, the optics of an NFL player brawling with WWE stars while recovering from a serious injury certainly gives fans a moment of pause.
For sure.
What a week of chaos, crisis, and controversy. As we look ahead to Week 12, we have some absolutely critical matchups that will likely determine the direction of the AFC and NFC playoff races.
Absolutely. It all kicks off with Thursday Night Football. The Texans, likely without Stroud, hosting the Bills in a critical wildcard battle. Then, the NFC East is likely on the line when the 8-2 Eagles visit the Cowboys.
We also have the spiraling Chiefs desperately trying to right the ship against the 9-2 Colts, which is a must-win for Kansas City's playoff aspirations. And finally, the Patriots, who are on an 8-game winning streak, hosting the Bengals, who are still trying to decide Joe Burrow's immediate future.
The narrative this season is truly unpredictable. We've seen established, strong contenders like the Chiefs and the Bengals spiral quickly into crisis, while teams we barely noticed, the 7-3 Bears, the 6-5 Panthers, are finding ways to stack up wins and seriously contend for playoff spots.
The AFC is a mess, the NFC picture is fluid, and the biggest names are facing the biggest problems.
They really are.
So as you look forward, consider this. Given the entirely unpredictable nature of this NFL season, what single factor, be it the rising tide of high-profile injuries, the rigidity of certain coaching philosophies like Dan Campbell's fourth-down obsession, or the sudden volatility of quarterback play, do you think determines which current playoff contender falls entirely out of the picture by the end of December?
That's the core question, because the margin for error is razor thin. Teams like the Chiefs or Bengals have the talent, but if the instability at the coaching level or a crucial injury at quarterback persists, one critical weakness can absolutely derail a season instantly. I would focus heavily on the health of the quarterbacks in Week 12.
Food for thought as we head into Week 12 in the holiday football season. Thanks for joining us for Football Army.